This is the fifth part of Ominous Parallels. This is from chapter 7, United They Fell. Because philosophy deals with broad abstractions, most people regard the subject as detached from life. They regard philosophy as they would a political party platform, as a set of floating generalities unrelated to action, generalities which are part ritualistic piety, part rationalization or cover-up, and part rhetorical, hot air. What, people ask, do these generalities have to do with the real issues of life, the issues which are immediate, topical, practical, the fierce debate in the Senate between the liberals and the conservatives, or the crisis of the economy, or the failure of schools, or the mood of the new generation on the campuses, or the bitter controversy over the latest shocking movie, play, painting, novel, or psychotherapeutic method? People cannot explain the developments in the fields that do interest them because they do not know the source of those developments. In every field, the source is the choices men make, which rest ultimately on their basic choices. Knowingly or not, those choices flow from men's basic ideas and values. The science of basic ideas is philosophy. If a man is skeptical about the role of philosophy in life, let him put aside philosophy books. Let him leave the cloistered ivory tower of theory and plunge into the sprawling realms of practice. Let him observe the concretes of his society's cultural life, its politics, its economics, its education, its youth movements, its art and religion and science. In every area, let him discover the main developments and then ask, why? In every area, the actors themselves will provide the answer. They seldom provide it in the form of philosophical speeches. Frequently, they offer moral declarations. Predominantly, however, they offer passing references, vague implications, and casual asides, which seem casual, except that the actors cannot avoid making them and counting on them. The references are the tip of the iceberg. They reveal the basic premises motivating a given development. When a man discovers that those references in every area reveal the same fundamentals at work, when he sees the same broad abstractions setting the terms for every action, issue, alternative, and turning point, then he will know the power that integrates the concretes of human life and moves human history. To understand the state of a society, one must discover the extent to which a given philosophy penetrates its spirit and institutions. On this basis, one can then explain a society's collapse, or, if it still has a chance, forecast its future. This is what can make intelligible the fact of Hitler's rise and the possibility of America's fall. At 3:15 p.m., on February 6, 1919, an historical National Assembly comprised of 423 freely elected delegates was formally convoked in the city of Weimar, Germany. Its purpose was to replace the imperial regime of the Hohenzollerns, which had collapsed after the country's defeat in the war, with a new German government operating in accordance with a new Republican constitution to be written by the delegates. The delegates appreciated the significance of their meetings. The product of their debates, they knew, was not to be a paper formality, but the document that would determine the political system and thus the future of the country. The leaders of the interim government, who were social democrats, had decided not to hold the assembly in Berlin because the risk of violence was too great. Germany's communists, refusing to participate in any parliamentary process, had taken to the streets crying, "All power to the Soviets." Besides, the leaders wished to emphasize the post-war desire to be free from Berlin, that is, from rule by Prussia. Prussia, the largest and most powerful German state, a semi-feudal, militarist, verboten-ridden tyranny, had dominated the nation's affairs since the first United Germany was formed in 1871. The new Germany, its leaders vowed, would be made in the image not of Potsdam but of Weimar. Weimar was a longtime home and symbol of Germany's non-Prussian tradition, the tradition of Goethe and Schiller, of classical humanism, of political liberalism. It was, in effect, the symbol of the German Enlightenment. The German Enlightenment was essentially different from its counterparts in England, France, or America. The difference may be condensed into a single fact. Whatever the greatness of its artistic representatives or their love of liberty, the top philosopher of the German Enlightenment, the figure universally taken as the country's leading champion of man, reason, and freedom, the most influential thinker of the Weimar tradition, is Immanuel Kant. In the meetings of the Weimar Assembly, however, during the fateful spring of 1919, the contending parties had little time to be concerned with philosophy or with Kant. They were concerned with politics and with Marx. The major contenders were the Social Democrats, an officially Marxist group carried over from the imperial period, who had emerged from the post-war elections as the nation's largest party, and various groups of conservative nationalists who opposed the creation of a republic. The Social Democrats continued all the long-time traditions of their party and sought support, in essence, from only one segment of the electorate, the proletariat, that is, the urban workers. The party's goal, in the words of one resolution, was to unite the entire strength of the proletariat in the struggle against the common enemy, capitalism and reaction. The purpose of the struggle, Social Democrat leaders told the workers, is to achieve a single ideal, socialism. Socialism, they said, means public ownership of property. It means an end to rule by bourgeois greed. It means a selfless, egalitarian, classless society in which all men live to serve the common good. Until the withering away of the state, the leaders added, socialism also means a powerful government. We must fight against the night watchman view of government in order to protect the age-old vestal fires of all civilization, the state against the liberal barbarians, said Ferdinand LaSalle, the most influential source of German social democracy in the 19th century and the greatest single figure in the party's history. The state is this unity of individuals in one moral whole, said LaSalle. The purpose of the state is, therefore, not that of protecting the personal freedom and property of the individual, which, according to the bourgeoisie, the individual brings with him into the state. The single most eloquent presentation of the Social Democrats' view of life is The Weavers, a play by the famous late 19th century dramatist Gerhard Hauptmann. The Weavers, which helped to make Hauptmann the idol of the socialist masses, deals with the German weaving industry in the 1840s. The play depicts a mass of oppressed toilers, flat-chested, coughing creatures with ashen-gray faces, broken, harried, worn out, creatures bowed by servility and tortured by constant hunger. The cause of all the misery, says the play, is the forces of the establishment, above all the fat, rapacious devils of manufacturers who live in palaces, gorge on pastries, and bathe their babies in wine and milk. Such men, the weavers cry, are hangmen, all, demons from the pit of hell. Your goal is known to everyone, to bleed us poor men dry. In the end, the weavers push too far, rise up in the name of social justice, sack the homes of the capitalists, wreck all their possessions, and then march off to smash once and for all the workers' chief enemy. From here, we'll go over to the steam power looms. All the trouble comes from those factories. The weavers convey perfectly the basic emotion and emotionalism which animated Germany's Marxists of both kinds, social democrat and communist. In their bitter sweeping denunciations of the class enemy and in their fiery predictions of its revolutionary overthrow, the two groups, whatever their differences in regard to tactics, were at one. In practice, however, the Social Democrats did not approve of sacking homes or smashing up power looms, and the struggle was not so much against class enemies as against communist guns. The Social Democrats opposed violence, a proletariat push, and a Bolshevist Russia. Not its ends, which they regard as noble, but its methods, which they regard as uncivilized and brutal. Socialism, they said, must come to Germany lawfully, by parliamentary decision, which they said meant a slow evolutionary process, inasmuch as a majority of the German people was anti-Marxist and would have to be re-educated. In the interim, party leaders decided they would continue to preach Marxist ideas with all the party's traditional zeal, but would confine themselves in practice to pursuing a limited reformist program in the Reichstag. Reformism in this context means a form of welfare statism. It means the policy of working within the framework of a semi-socialist, semi-capitalist, mixed system in order to secure the passage or strengthening of piecemeal pro-labor programs, including such items as the extension of union power, the 8-hour day, minimum wages, unemployment insurance, government industry, and higher graduated taxes on upper-income individuals and on business profits. The party, said its Marxist oratory, rejects the kind of temporizing social welfare measures introduced in the imperial era by Bismarck, measures which merely delay and subvert the coming revolution. Such measures, said the party's reformist practice, are precisely what the party is fighting for. We stand solidly, said the democratic face of social democracy, with the moderate bourgeois parties in defense of the republican system, which protects the civil rights and liberties of all men. This capitalistic republic, said the social faces of social democracy, is merely a transitional stage, a necessary evil, on the road to a truly moral society in which men will enjoy something greater than liberty, economic equality. The workers, said August Bebel, a revered pre-war party leader, has little interest in a state in which political liberty is merely the goal. What good is mere political liberty to him if he is hungry? Down with the sham liberty of capitalism, shouted impassioned speakers at party rallies. Not now, pleaded the same men the next morning. First, we must give the capitalists a chance to rebuild the country after war. it seems impossible for us to transfer industry into the possession of the community at a time when the productive forces of the country are almost exhausted. It is impossible to socialize when there is hardly anything to socialize. Give me chastity and continence, but not yet, said Augustine in a famous prayer, expressing the torture of a profound inner conflict. Transposed to the political arena, this in essence was the conflict and the torture of post-war Germany's leading party. The Social Democrats had been condemned as ineffectual by virtually all commentators on the Weimar Republic. The standard explanation is that the party leader's moral character, or experience, or strategy was inadequate. In fact, the root of the party's deficiency was not personal or tactical. It was ideological. In their Marxist ideals, the Social Democrats were heirs to Germany's central collectivist tradition. In their reputation, in their Republican methods, they were clinging to remnants of an opposite, and in Germany, weak and peripheral, tradition. The Enlightenment worldview. The result was a party incapable by its nature of providing a nature with decisive leadership, a party impaled from the outset on a fundamentalist contradiction. It did not take long for the political jokes to begin. Their butt was revolutionists who wanted peace and quiet, proletarian militants who made collaboration with the bourgeoisie an essential policy, socialists who refused to socialize. Such were the men whom the German conservatives at the time took to be champions of a scientific approach to life. The conservatives, whose main political outlet was the nationalistic party, were the groups that sought a restoration of the monarchy. These groups included most of the leaders of the imperial establishment, such as the wealthy Junker landlords, the powerful officer corps, and many prominent German judges, bureaucrats, industrialists. Two groups in particular were the most influential in proselytizing for the conservative viewpoint. One was the country's largest religious denomination, the Lutheran Church, which, faithful to the ideas of its founders, had long been a bulwark of Prussianism. The other was the professions trained to teach young minds, the educational professorial establishment, which, transferred intact from the empire to the republic, remained to the end a loyal product of the Kaisers. What socialism was to the leftists, nationalism was to the conservatives. It was their ideology, their political ideal, their common bond. Nationalism, in this context, means the belief in the superiority of the German soul over Western decadence, and, as corollary, the belief in historic mission of the fatherland, its mission to guide or rule the world's lesser peoples. The conservatives did not attempt to prove the inherent superiority of all things German. They felt it, and that was enough for them. The German soul, they often said, rejects intellectual analysis. It functions decisively by instinct. It rejects the plodding debates of isolated individuals which characterize parliamentary government. Instead, it demands organic unity and a state embodying the principle of authority. Does that sound like rule of law? It rejects all talk about man's rights as mere Western selfishness. What it cherishes is duty and self-sacrifice for the fatherland. Most of the conservatives were religious men who regarded their basic ideas as inherent in a Christian approach to life. Sound familiar? Typically, the public statements of these men dwelt on such themes as the value of faith, the evil of atheism, the importance of church and family, and the need of religious schools to guide the young and immunize them against radicalism. Whether they invoke religion or not, however, the conservatives characteristically reviled the rational republic. This was not meant as sarcasm. In their opinion, the republic was rational. On this subject, all were prepared to agree with Luther. There is on earth among all dangers no more dangerous thing than a richly endowed and adroit reason, Luther had said. Reason must be deluded, blinded, and destroyed. In economics, as in philosophy and politics, the conservatives stood for tradition, German tradition. Faithful to its dominant 19th century ideas, Germany, alone among the major Western nations, had never entered the era of classic liberalism. In varying forms and degrees, the German states had characteristically been regulated economies. Then in the Prussian-dominated empire, Bismarck and his successors had entrenched many new controls, including the policy of awarding special favors from the Reich government, subsidies, protective tariffs, and the like, to the country's big landowners and industrialists. In addition, to placate the rising labor movement, Bismarck in the 1880s had created in Germany the world's first welfare state, complete with programs for compulsory health insurance, workmen's compensation, and old age and disability insurance. Bismarck's conservative supporters at the time, including the professorate and the Lutheran Church, had accepted such programs enthusiastically as a natural expression of Prussian paternalism, social-mindedness, and sense of duty. The base of Bismarck's approach was established by the so-called Socialists of the Chair, a group of highly influential social science professors at the German universities. The ideas of these men, noted von Mises, were almost identical with those later held by British Fabians and the American institutionalists. As to the Lutherans, most had followed the head of such figures as Pastor Adolf Stocker. They had rejected capitalism as an evil, Jewish idea, incompatible with the spirit of Christianity. In no other country had the idea of social reform taken hold of people's minds as thoroughly as in Germany. And this is a summary from one historian who makes no attempt to explain the fact. The Weimar conservatives followed their Bismarckian mentors. They advocated all the imperial types of controls, programs, taxes, and rejected two policies. One was unhampered Western capitalism, which they often described as plutocracy, pacifism, or Jewish greed. The other was radical experiments, that is, any new government programs designed to tip the balance of power in favor of labor. In place of both policies, the conservatives demanded private property in the German sense. The German sense, they said, means a recognition of private ownership in some areas, combined with the principle that property must be used to serve the welfare of the nation as determined by the authorities of the state. The deadliest enemy of the country, the conservatives declared, is socialism. Their working definition of socialism was state control of the economy for the sake of benefiting the lower classes. They fumed against it, demanding state control of the economy for the sake of benefiting the upper classes. The Nationalist Party was regarded in Germany as a political right. The term right in Germany had nothing to do and did not mean classic liberalism, individual rights, a market economy, or capitalism. It stood for the opposite of all these ideas. It stood, in economies as in politics, for an explicit version of statism. In 1919, the conservatives knew that it was still too soon for them to achieve their social goals. They knew they had to give the new government a chance. They resolved to bide their time and see what the defenders of the rational republic would do. The defenders did not consist only of Marxists. The Social Democrats had two indispensable bourgeois allies, without whom neither the new constitution nor the republic to which it gave birth would have been possible. These two allies were the Center Party and the Democratic Party. The Center Party had been organized in 1870 to serve as the political arm of the Catholic Church in Germany. Whatever their disagreements on other issues, the centrists prided themselves on being united as moral force able to combat the spread of decadence in post-war Germany. The moral values which party leaders upheld included faith in God, a return to commandments of traditional Christianity, and obedience to authority, not only religious but also political, in parentheses, since, according to Catholic teaching, political power derives from God. We're not going to get into that now, but that, of course, is a jaded and deliberately so view of God's relationship to human government. The chief cause of the country's spiritual decay, the leader said, was the modern trend to secularism and free thinking. Free thinking to these men did not mean merely atheism. It meant independent thought on any philosophical question. A member of the Reichstag once declared, "It is impossible for me to recognize the moral basis of any action if I do not understand it." The centrist present responded by calling out, "Materialism, materialism." Like their counterparts in other lands, the centrists did not rely only on the methods of persuasion to spread their ideas. They sought to impose their moral code on the rest of the country by force of law, urging measures such as the prohibition of abortion, restrictions on sexual practices condemned by the church, the censorship of pornography, and a statute to protect German youth from, quote, worthless and obscene literature. The party also demanded state financing of Catholic public schools. On matters not decreed by their religion, the centrists often differed with one another. Some were political conservatives who did not approve of the new German system. Others were liberals who did. Every government enjoys God's blessing, whether it be monarchic or republican, a party spokesman told the Weimar Assembly. Not really. On one basic question of politics, however, all factions were in agreement. The party rejected both capitalism and socialism. Capitalism, the Catholics held, is a godless system. Capitalism, they said, represents an inherently secular approach to life, one which counts on man's unaided intellect and rewards his striving for material success. It also represents an amoral approach. It claims a man's right to act on his own judgment, which implies a sinful permissiveness on sexual and political questions. Above all, in historian Koppel Pinson's words, the motive of self-interest and the incentive of competition ran counter to Catholic religious belief. which espouses social rather than an individual ethic. Society was a Corpus Christi mysticum, mystical body of Christ, and the individual is not to be considered an isolated phenomenon. As a socialism, the centrists rejected it for one fundamental reason. Socialism, the party argued, is impractical idealism. Marx's vision, of a perfect egalitarian society on earth is noble but impossible. It is impossible because of original sin, which, no matter what man's aspirations, dooms him to greed and failure. A quote, to suffer and endure is the lot of humanity, end the quote, from Pope Leo XIII. It continues, let men strive as they may, no strength and no artifice will ever succeed in banishing from human life the ills and troubles which beset it. Since capitalism is evil and socialism is too good for man, the party held, a compromise is necessary. This is a quote. On the one hand, said a prominent German Catholic leader in 1848, we see a rigid clinging to the right of property, and on the other hand, an equally determined denial of all property rights, and we desperately seek some mediation between these two extremes. That's the end of the quote. The mediation he reached was the idea that man does have a right to property, but that this right is not unlimited. It is conditioned by man's overriding moral obligation to use his property in such a way as to serve the general welfare. Since every German group repudiated individualism, centrism in the Weimar Republic meant a middle ground, not between socialism and capitalism, but between statism of the Marxist variety, to benefit the lower classes, and statism of the conservative variety, to benefit the upper classes. In the early post-war years, the conservative centrists, like monarchists throughout the nation, were relatively subdued, and the party's left wing was in the ascendancy. It was a wing eager to form a working coalition with the social democratic reformists. The final member of the Weimar coalition was the Democratic Party, a middle-class liberal group organized in 1918, which included among its supporters a roster of famous names from the academic and business worlds unmatched by any of the other groups. This party, in Pynsent's words, was the one most committed to the ideals of a democratic republic, and it made its appeal largely to those in Germany who were truly democratic and socially minded, but who rejected all notions of a class or religious party. In the January 1909 elections, there was an impressive show of support for such an approach, over 5 million votes, about 19% of the total. At the Weimar Convention, Friedrich Naumann, the party's first elected leader, stated the democratic viewpoint in politics. The new republic, he told the delegates, should represent a sort of compromise peace between capitalism and socialism. Such a compromise, the Democrats said, means the acceptance of individual rights and of a powerful state, one strong enough to ensure that citizens exercise their rights in the service of the community. It means the sanctity of private property and the socialization of monopolies. It means the rejection of egalitarianism and a large-scale redistribution of income to benefit the poor. In the mid-20s, one of the party's election posters eloquently depicted its animating viewpoint. The poster, which would have been suitable for all the Republican groups, featured a beefy Olympic runner symbolizing determination, along with a banner reading, "Nothing will sway us from the middle of the road." And at that, I'm going to leave it at this part. We will continue as soon as possible with what would be part 6 of The Ominous Parallels, written by Leonard Peikoff in 1982. I think you can probably pick up what they are and what it spells for us in the United States in the very near future.